Our first speaker, Clint H.
Excuse me.
Hi, my name is Clint. I'm an alcoholic. When I was asked to speak tonight, presumably somewhere along the theme of the Soberfest, my first thought was to complete the sentence, happiness is a byproduct. As I've continued to think about the theme, I believe I'm confirmed in that opinion. To say what I really mean, I suppose I can be most clear by following the classic AA tradition of saying a bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. As I begin telling you about what I used to be like, I'll begin with my childhood. And as I tell you some things about my childhood, you might jump to the conclusion that I was at best a difficult child. Perhaps. But it wasn't my fault. I'm a fourth-generation native-born Texan. At least on the Henderson side of the family. The Hendersons of Texas were just average successful farmers before the war, and I'm sure you can recognize which war my grandmother had in mind. Her family, however, the Farrells of North Carolina, were reportedly far more prosperous before that same war ruined them and forced them to go to Texas, where she met and married my grandfather. With a whim of iron, my grandmother maintained the fiction of still being the pampered darling of the plantation amid the harsh realities of being a farm wife in a semi-arid part of Texas. My father was one of three brothers, the only one of three brothers, who left the economic and psychological restrictions of Coleman County, took himself, his eighth grade education, into the U.S. Postal Service, from which he retired at the age of 60, having offered his shoulders as a platform on which his children could stand as they reached toward a life of which he could only dream. My admiration of my father for his courage, his strength, his utter integrity, and his unfailing gentleness were exceeded only by my love for him. It was in Waco, Texas, that Dad met and married my mother. Now, Dad was a six-footer and a rather quiet man. I've always suspected that he married that lively little five-foot-two woman with the olive skin, the bronze-red hair, and the cobalt blue eyes because he thought she'd keep him entertained for life. She did. I know very little about my mother's people. Her father was a Connecticut Yankee who had become estranged from his family, wandered down to Texas, and in the Waco of his day become known as the drunkard down at the wagon yard. My grandmother's people, the Cooks, had immigrated from Ireland to Ohio, where grandmother was born, thence to Indiana, and in the course of her first marriage, she ended up down in Texas. After that husband died, she met and married my grandfather, Worden. It's from this grandfather that I inherited my susceptibility from alcoholism, and from that grandmother that I inherited my susceptibility to diabetes. I think Mother should have done better about selecting my ancestors. I was born in my parents' home near Waco, Texas, 5 years after my elder sister, 5 years before my younger sister. The stories of my childhood and the years before my focused memory are graphic and colorful. If they are true, I think there must have been times when my parents wondered that they hadn't made a mistake when I was born and kept the placenta. On the one hand, I was a child who was very eager to please. Pushed, I was capable of tear-the-wall-down tantrums that exhausted everybody in the household. My mother and I, who loved each other intensely, seemed engaged in intermittent but unrelenting warfare until I was well into adolescence. Actually, there are only about two incidents from my childhood that I think have any pertinence at all for the evening. One relates to my appearance. I've spoken of my admiration for my father. I can't remember not longing desperately to look like my father. The fact is, no one ever said that I looked like Dad for the simple and adequate reason that I didn't and don't. The point is, that is the first lie, the first basic lie I ever remember telling myself. I told myself I didn't want to look like Dad, the absolute opposite of what the fact was. And I maintained that lie until I was almost 25 years old, by which time I had become quite practiced at lying to myself. It's a very confusing way to live. The second one relates to the summer before I was 8 years old. Dad had been transferred from Waco to Amarillo the preceding year. Mother, my two sisters, and I were visiting friends in Waco when I became critically ill with Bright's disease, nephritis, and inflammation of the kidneys. It was far more serious in those days before the advent of, I think it's primarily the sulfa drugs. One night, as I lay semi-comatose, my head and body both swollen grotesquely, almost double normal size, I aroused enough to know that Mother was telling Dad via long-distance phone call about my illness. When she hung up, not knowing that I was conscious, she began to cry. I didn't like to see my mother cry. I asked her what was wrong. She was too shaken to shield me. She said she was afraid I was going to die. I opened my arms to her. She came to them as I assured her that I was not going to die. The point is, I thereafter drifted off to sleep in the serene notion that I had settled the issue. It was the first time I ever remember trying to play God, and I liked the sense of power. I can condense the next decade or so of my life into very few sentences. My recuperation lasted for over a year, or nearly a year. During that time, I was overprotected, sheltered. I was also on a very strict diet that prohibited the use of any animal protein beyond fish and fowl. And I entered on what was to become recurrent periods of obesity. At first, being unable to play with other boys, later becoming unwilling to compete with them from my position of decreasing competence to do so successfully, I turned my attention to academic achievement. And then I told a second big lie. I told myself it didn't matter that I was fat and weak. It made no difference that I was merely tolerated in class because I was doing what was important. I was one of the school big guns in interscholastic league competition. I became arrogant toward others and imperious in my demands upon myself to score first in everything. I had devoured public school by the time I was 16 and completed 7 years of university by the time I was 22. Beyond my reference to Grandpa Henderson, Grandpa Worden, I've made no reference to alcohol because there's been nothing to say. My parents were more than teetotalers. They were prohibitionists. Moreover, they were so active in church work that every time the church doors opened, I fell in. For a while, that posed a bit of a problem to me. You see, we lived out in the country, and we went to a big church in the city. Now, nobody there was very impressed by what I did in school. And Sunday school offered very little recognition for academic achievement. Coincidentally and fortuitously, my father's cousin was a piano teacher and a church organist. By the time I was 14, I was assistant organist at the church. What an ego massage that was. I didn't like the way the singing was going. I put on the crescendo pedal, and believe me, they sang at the tempo I wanted them to sing at. It really wasn't strange, granting my background, that I should decide to enter the ministry. My first contact with alcohol came when I was a college sophomore, age 17. I was in the cast of a USO benefit play, and during rehearsals, the director celebrated a birthday. One of the gifts he received was a bottle of wine, which he shared with the cast. I'm sure I don't have to try to describe to you the hypnotic force his offering me a glass of wine had on me. This was the forbidden fruit. I didn't take the drink, but I resented the pluperfect hell out of my refusal to take it. Actually, I didn't drink at all until I was past 21, and at first only wine. I guess that's because all anybody ever offered me. There came one landmark evening when I visited a friend's apartment in his absence, and in his refrigerator there was a half-filled bottle of rum, well chilled. I tasted it. That was okay. I finished the bottle. I decided it was much nicer than wine. I was off and reaching for my stride. Let's take a summary look at me as I embarked on my ministerial career at age 22. Well, in the first place, I had believed that all of my motivations to do anything had to be 100% pure go, or I had no real motivation. Now, I sensed, rather than even thought, that my motivation to enter the ministry was not 100% undiluted idealism. Therefore, I had no motivation. I was a hollow man. The word hypocrite was one that I would not allow myself to think in any connection. It never occurred to me to admit that I'd made a mistake. As I understand my higher power today, I had not made a mistake. But at any rate, the idea of preaching was insupportable to me. I was sure I would speedily be found out. I had nothing to say because I was this hollow man. My dilemma was resolved for me when somebody offered me a job in Christian education. That was peachy fine. All I had to do there was teach other people how to bear witness to a truth I felt myself unable to witness to authentically. That's real pathetic. I'll teach you to work the 12 steps I don't know how to work. In the second place, I felt that I had to have the total love, or at least the admiration, of everybody whom I met. Otherwise, I would surely shrivel into non-existence. I would go to any length to get it. I would do my flaming sword dance. I would turn myself inside out to win your approval. Now, there was a flip side to that. Should you turn your back on all these gifts I was lavishing on the altar of love, guard your rear flank. And of course, in the third place, every task I performed had to be done flawlessly, or it was no damn good at all, and moreover, I was a no good louse. Since all of my performance was necessarily imperfect. And since, in fact, I did receive numerous personal and professional rewards of some merit, I was worse than a fraud and a cheat. I was an outright thief. This was me as I started out. What happened? Well, you know, the scripture tells us about how St. Paul became missionary to the Gentiles. It seemed I was to spend the next decade and a half as missionary to the Gentiles. It took a fairly affluent congregation to afford a man minister of education. Moreover, it was a mark of ecclesiastical chic to have one. The service you got wasn't necessarily any better. In my case, initially, it certainly was no better. I was asked to leave that first position in an elegant suburb of Dallas after 2 years. for the simple reason that I had not mastered the tools of my trade. I didn't know what to do, and I didn't do it. In 1948, I went into what felt like punishing and self-inflicted exile in Louisville, Kentucky. You may be sure that there I began mastering the tools of my trade, and there I began my first serious experience with drinking. You see, a staff member of a large church in a metropolitan area escapes the close scrutiny that the minister of a small congregation in a small town may have. I think that there may have been evenings during the nearly 3 years I lived in Louisville that I went to bed sober. I'm positive that most of them I was not even approximately sober. 1951 was a vintage year, so to speak. I went to a new job in Nashville, Tennessee, and it was there that I really mastered enough of my craft that I attained my first national professional recognition. More importantly, that was the year at a professional conference. I met this striking young colleague with the Titian blonde hair, eyes the color of sherry held to the sunlight. My sisters swear that I wrote some nonsense about having met a goddess in a dream. I know I never wrote any such drivel. At any rate, our fourth date after that conference, 4 months later, was our wedding date. The marriage lasted 4 days short of 25 years. It was in Nashville that our first set of twin sons was born. I no longer thought about liquor. I drank sparingly and rarely on the social occasions I did drink. In 1955, I moved to Lexington, Kentucky, where I mastered as much of my trade as I wanted to master. I also became reviewer and critic for manuscripts submitted to our National Publishing House. I wrote curriculum myself. I submitted numerous articles to professional journals, both ecumenical and denominational. Our second set of twin sons was born in Lexington. I continue to act like a social drinker, despite having the sense many times that I was surviving in a stained glass jungle. In 1961, I made my first major career change, became a denominational Christian education executive for my church, my judicatory, in the state of Missouri. There, while I lived in Jefferson City for 10 years, I did what was undoubtedly the best and most satisfying work of my life up to that point. It was during those years, too, that fissures began to appear in my marriage, hairline cracks that reached the core of the relationship. My goddess, you see, was really a woman with needs of her own. Many of them as irrational as mine, all of them as imperious in their demands as mine. In 1964, she resumed her professional career at our congregation in Jefferson City. I think we knew by then that our marriage was in difficulty, but we didn't say anything to each other. We were two ordained clergy, trained to counsel people in the solving of problems. We couldn't admit that we had problems of our own, and we certainly sought no help. What we did instead was to begin to keep liquor in our house for the first time. As the years passed, it took increasingly frequent trips to the friendly neighborhood liquor store to keep the supply in the house. It should have alerted us if we had been paying attention to that sort of detail. We weren't. Nonetheless, I think that our sons grew up in a fairly healthy atmosphere. If nothing else, both of us were too busy to pay any attention to them, but we still, getting out of their way, supplied them with enough supportive structures that their life went along well. In 1971, I made my second major career change, leaving church work, moving to Oregon, and entering service with the state government. That move, which was undertaken in part as in the hope that our marriage might begin to heal itself, backfired. I no longer traveled away from home half the time. She no longer had anything to occupy her considerable energies except herself and the family. We were together. Oh, my God, were we together. The two of us, four teenage boys, an Airedale, a Beagle, and a Tomcat, for 6 months in a two-bedroom apartment. I had by then begun, with more force than finesse, to get us to help. Well, it didn't work. The drinking increased. For the first time, it was noticeable beyond ourselves and our intimate circle. She also became, for a time, a medications junkie. By late 1972, we entered into a trial separation at my insistence. Early in 1973, largely in response to our mutual learned helplessness, a trial reconciliation with a formal contract in writing yet. It was actually in shambles in 6 weeks, though the marriage lasted for another 3 years. My drinking steadily increased. My control was shaky enough that it became rumored abroad that I might have a problem. In 1976, we were divorced at my insistence. That divorce was total and utter defeat for me as a person. Life had the brazen effrontery to get completely out of control, and many a cup of the forbidden grape must drown the memory of that insolence. Within 2 years, there was no vestige of control on my drinking, at least a fifth a day. Somehow, my job performance remained barely acceptable, though far below my own standards, my record of potential. I was utterly miserable. I held on to only tattered shreds of relationships with my four sons, two of them by then married, two still in college. In October of 1978, a colleague confronted me with indisputable evidence of a blackout. It was terrifying. God knows how many had slipped by unnoticed. I was literally scared into AA. Beginning with the BNP group in Portland, to which I was referred to my boss, he thought that was a good place for me to start. Steps one and two came, well, perhaps not easily, but unmistakably. In February of 1979, I went on what I hope is my last drunk, and it was a humdinger. Among other things, I went to a tavern, which was an errant, a gross violation of an unspoken and unwritten, almost unconscious rule that I had. I always did my drinking at home where there weren't sots taking up the supply of liquor. Mind you, I have only the very vaguest and most scattered recollections of that evening. Most of what I tell you is what I was told later by other people. I remember surfacing at one point of the evening, realizing with some surprise that I was in a tavern, seated with a group of people, only one of whom I knew, and that but slightly, and wondering what in the hell I was doing here. The next thing I remember is being at the steering wheel of my car in a parking lot, lots of people around talking, somebody shining a flashlight in my face. The next I remember a man with whom I worked, whom I didn't particularly like, was getting in my car, presumably to drive me home. I next surfaced. I was in my bed. It was night. I could hear nobody else in the house. My son David was living with me at the time. I had no idea when it was, what actually had happened. I got ready to get out of bed. There were three empty rum bottles at my bed. And friends, they were empty 151 proof rum bottles. I stumbled downstairs, phoned my colleague, and found out when it was and what had transpired. Apparently nobody in the tavern had known I was drunk. Yet when I got outside on my way to my car, I had fallen twice, badly cutting my face. I never got all the blood off the dashboard and upholstery of that car. I had repelled all further help when kind strangers each time had helped me to my feet. I'd got in my Buick Electra, put it in reverse, and zoomed backwards into my colleague's compact imported car that was parked right behind me. He had talked the police out of giving me a ticket. The accident had happened on private property. He had driven me home. I presume had cleaned my wound, dressed it, put me to bed. I never did ask him that. The incident had my undivided attention. I was abashed, shamed by the unmitigated kindness of this man whom I had had the audacity to despise slightly, and who, for the love of God, owed me no thanks after I'd ruined his car. Well, at that point, I took step three after a fashion. With consummate grace, I threw up my hands and said, "Okay, God, I give up. Do some good to me." And there I sat for 18 months in AA, my idle hands empty, my dry life barren. Until a novel idea entered my keen and massive mind. Something more was required of me than to sit and wait for God to do some good to me, like haul ass off dead center. It made no sense to think of increasing my weekly trips to Portland. The obvious answer was to join AA in Salem. And I did so with only one niggling little reservation. I had, for God's sake, been an alcoholism counselor in Salem. Sooner or later, inevitably, I was going to encounter one of my former clients, and how was I going to manage that with sufficient grace not to jeopardize his sobriety? Well, in the course of time, the inevitable happened. It was worse than I had dreamed possible. He didn't remember me. What am I like now? Very much like a young child. If my 60 years were reduced to the scale of 1 year, my period of sobriety is 1 month long, 1/12 of my existence. I've continued my Portland AA, becoming active in my home group, Salem Unity, serving it for 2 years and after a fashion as GSR, participating regularly in the Kaiser Step Study Group, because I know as a young child that I have much left to learn about how to apply these principles in all my affairs. My ruptured relationships are restored. My work is again up to standards, truly a satisfying experience. Happiness? In seeking to apply AA principles to all my affairs, I have dug down deep enough that I accidentally tapped into that river of merriment that flows beneath life, and joy bubbled up into my life.
Thank you, Clint. There's a lady here celebrating her first birthday. Her name is Irma. How about a hand for Irma? Stand up, Irma. All right, another announcement. This meeting is being taped. If anyone would like one, you can pick it up at the taping table after the meeting. You know, I had planned to stand here and shed quite a few tears to demonstrate my gratitude at Alcoholics Anonymous. But instead, I'm going to break a confidence or something here because I found a note in the big book up here I thought I'd share with you. It says, "I love you, Dad, very, very much. I don't know who the book belongs to. And I always will, too. And I hope you know that, always. Love you lots. Signed, Lori." Now, that's pretty neat. Next, I'd like to introduce Ralph. Old Ralph L.
My name is Ralph, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm happy to be here tonight. Really happy. I wish I could add a little class to what's happening and what's going on up here, but let me tell you, I'm also from Texas. My wife hates it when I say that because she ever hears from me is very gross jokes from Texas. I promise not to tell you any this evening. If Buddy was here, he'd help me. He knows them all. I don't. He leads me on. My family was barring a little bit from what Clint's saying. My dad actually jumped ship in Seattle. He was from Sweden, and he ended up, I think, in Texas because the sheriff run him out of New Mexico. I'm not sure. My dad, incidentally, was a practicing alcoholic till the day he died, and it always was a regret I had that I did not reach him after I got to the fellowship. My mother, who never took a drink in her life, made the mistake of marrying my dad to save him. She was an enabler. And I don't like to dwell on, do not dwell on that part of my family because I found out as a child that one of my uncles on her side was a horse thief. I just kind of related to this guy. I thought he'd be my kind of person, but he was not around when I finally got old enough to get to move out. Bernie talked about the things he had. Bernie, the long bridges where I was under, they count. I was a hell of a long bridge I come from out from under, and that's one of the reasons why I'm so grateful to be here this evening. And very, very happy about that. I want to talk on some things. I won't have a damn thing to do with your sobriety, but Hope was a member or come into Alcoholics Anonymous in Grants Pass. And when she and I was talking this evening, and she said she had had 17 years of sobriety. And I'm thinking, and I said afterwards, my God, how time does go. You know, what beautiful, beautiful, wonderful years they are. And Hope and I shared, I don't know if you know anything, but years ago in Grants Pass, RAA was somewhat different. Hope wanted to put a sign up on the outside of town welcoming people to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was a great idea, and by God, we put the sign up. There was a little trouble in the group. Hope, where are you, Hope? Stand up and let them have a look at you. There you go. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous on Easter Sunday a few years ago. I was so grateful for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I wanted to do anything I could to help the fellowship. And let me tell you some of the things I did. It was a small group at the time. We were only 10 people, and I think there's only two of them still alive besides myself. I was the youngest person in the group, and I was 35. So, you know, it's in those days, they tell me that if your shoes matched, well, you didn't really belong in AA yet. We did discuss that once in a while, but I won out because I stayed. But because I was feeling so grateful for the fellowship, and because I had a wonderful group, and I think if there's a message tonight I want to leave is, for Christ's sake, if you haven't got a home group, get a home group. Because let me tell you the things that I was doing, that my group was so loving. At the time, I didn't think it was very loving, but it was loving. Is that the buzzer? Have I had 15 minutes already? Anyway, he's got a buzzer up here, you know. It gives you the word. One of the things I learned in alcohol, very first when I was in AA, I did not pay any attention to the 12 traditions they read. I thought, what the hell is that all about? And so, because I felt so grateful for the fellowship, and where I went into the group in Grants Pass, we met in the grandstand, in the bandstand, in the park. And they had the band up above. You remember the old bands? Tell me you will, I'm sure. Not maybe a hell of a lot of you won't either. But anyway, down below was shower rooms. And the shower room floors went this way. And I got into that group, and someone said, alcoholism is a disease. And I thought, by God, we deserve better than to sit in creaky chairs in a shower room where people could look in the half windows, you know. So I was going to help the group. And without asking the group, I went downtown in Grants Pass. And Grants Pass at the time was 6,000 people, and everybody in town knew I was a town drunk. And they were so grateful I got sober. Believe me, they were grateful, especially the police. That I managed to raise $1,000 from the business people downtown for Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were going to buy a building. My group had a special little sign. You know, they went like this, and I knew that meant I had to go and talk to them. And they got me in the corner, and they read the 12 traditions to me. I've learned everything the hard way, believe me. And there's a tradition in there that says we don't accept outside money, you know? We don't do those sort of things. I had to do the thing that I've had to do so many times since I've been in the fellowship. I had to go and make amends. I had to go back and tell these businessmen and give back the ones that gave me money, their money back, and say we couldn't take that. And they thought I belonged to kind of a strange outfit, you know? But that's all right. It was the best thing in the world for me. As a result of that, they said there are some things we can do, and by God, I learned we could write New York, and they sent us some stuff, and pretty soon we got the High-Low Club down there. But that was down the road after I learned a few things. Something else I did, which they say is not the right thing to do, but at least it kept me sober. They say we're not supposed to go out and drag bums off the bar drunks off the bar stools. I did. The officers, the bar owners and people in town, they knew it when they saw me coming. I was looking for drunks. And I never got one of them sober, but I kept myself sober. But the group got me together. They did the old thing, you know, come over here, Ralph. And we had a nice little discussion about that, something that has to do with promotion and attraction. And I was doing, you know, they're still arguing about promoting the attraction and all that stuff. And I'm not so sure I was wrong. Those bartenders knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and a few of those people did come to AA. We had one bartender that come to AA, and I have a resentment against this guy. He come to one meeting years ago. Someone said alcoholism is a disease, so something we always say to the new people. He said, is that a fact? And he never come back, and he never drank. He never drank. I know because I used to check him at the... I wanted him to get drunk because they told me, and when you got to attend meetings, you know? And that sucker didn't get drunk, and the last I heard, he was sober, and I'm looking back, I thank God. It worked for him. It never would have worked for me, but it worked for him. Well, one other thing I did for my group... That's what my group used to do, too. We used to have what we called intergroup down there, and it was three groups got together, one from Klamath Falls, one from Grants Pass, and one from Medford. And we were very small. It was 10 people in our group, and we'd get our wives and whoever else we could get, and we'd all go to Medford, and they'd have a big potluck, and the people from Klamath Falls come over. It was a sharing. It was a wonderful experience. But I watched those people, and I knew I could do better if they ever gave me a chance. Well, they made a mistake and gave me a chance, and it happened to be that I was 12-stepping a man who had a wife who could sing. God, she could sing. She had a beautiful voice, and she could sing without any accompaniment at all. And I was so impressed with her. And I was also working with another guy who was had a son that could play the accordion. So you know what we did when we had intergroup? We had an accordion play, this first song, and we had a little music with our intergroup. The guys, the old-timers were sitting in the back, and I noticed they were beginning to shake their head a little bit. I just thought maybe I was impressing them, so. We ended the meeting with this lady getting up and singing the Lord's Prayer, and she did have a beautiful voice. But guess what happened right after the meeting? It was, well, we had a little discussion. And I learned something else. You're not supposed to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But that group, they taught me so much, and they were so good to me. Let me tell you just one other thing they did. I'll quit in another minute. He's over here kicking me. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on a Sunday, Easter Sunday, and my sponsor, it kind of hurt because one of the guys we went to see was my butcher. And the butcher said, I've been waiting for you for a long time, Ralph. And I thought I'd had it covered really well, you know. But I started AA with a lie. The guy came up to my house. I went down and bought some stuff, had my morning breakfast, down at the Owl in Grants Pass, and brought home a six-pack. And I see some other people that drank at the Owl, did you? Or something like that. Doesn't it smell bad? Oh, God, that was a horrible odor in that bar. Anyway, I got a six-pack and came home, and something crossed my mind that I don't know what it was, but I was hurting. No worse than I'd hurt before. My wife had already left me. I had everybody I owed money all over town. I had bad checks out to you know what. The only thing that was keeping me from being sent up was the fact I still had a job, and I don't know how I hung on to that job. Afterwards, I found out that I almost didn't have that when I went to the man and told him I was a member of AA. Anyway, I called, and my butcher showed up, and another man, and he said, you got anything to drink in the house? Well, I was at the point where money was a little short, and I was not drinking good bourbon or anything. I was drinking beer, because that's the only thing I could afford anymore. I couldn't drink wine. Wine made me sick, so I'd already tried that out. So I said, no, just what I got in my hand. So they said, well, you pour that out, and I did, and I still had the remainder of a six-pack in the refrigerator. And then the suckers, they said, let's take a ride. And they took me out in the country to a man's house who was around the fellowship for, at the time, he had 15 or 20 years. And we spent all day out there in the goddamn country. I'm a city boy. And you get me off the sidewalks, streetlights, and asphalt, I get a little nervous. And I was quick anyway, you understand? I was quick. But those people spent the day with me, and they spoiled, you know, there was no Easter, there was no dinner for them that day. There was dinner, but not much. And they brought me back to town that night, and they took me back up to my place and let me off. And I made my first meeting on a Monday night, and what I'm trying to get to is, I said on Monday night, I said, well, I know I can stay sober weekends. I haven't been sober on a weekend in years and years and years. And the fact of the matter is, I hadn't been sober any day for years and years and years. But, you know, I'm trying to let these... I was afraid they were going to kick me out of AA if they found out how bad I was, really. They said, well, that's okay. We're going to have a little poker game on Saturday. So, Saturday afternoon. So, all 10 of the people in AA got together, and they brought their family. And I got dressed up and took off. And I got there, and they said, where's your wife? I had taken the fact of the matter is, my wife wouldn't go with me, you know, for years she'd never gone with me. And that was something new to me. I didn't know you were supposed to bring your wife along. So the fellowship taught me something else. It brought me back. Unfortunately, my wife and I, we couldn't make it because it was too much hurt. But that was what I got out of the group I had. It was a wonderful group, and I'll remember them as long as I live. And those 10 people, one of them is still around. He's here in Salem now. It's ONC. ONC, I had a particular resentment against this man, and that was something else that the group taught me. Whenever any of our people had trouble, we always rounded up money, food, whatever, and took the family. If it was a man that got drunk, well, the man lived across the street and he was having trouble and he didn't make it, but he had 5 kids and a wonderful wife. And so the man I had the resentment against, who when they said pray for, I prayed for, and he got angry and left the group. He went into a different group. He didn't know I'd prayed for him. I'm always careful how I pray anymore after that. He brought down 4 or 5 sacks of groceries and left them at the house and said, "Would you take them across and give them to Tiny, but don't tell him where it come from?" And I had a resentment against that guy. Those are the things that I learned in my group. 3 things kept me sober, and I've expanded that to 1 more now. Of course, the will. It was my sponsor. It was my group. The 12 steps and God as I understand him. Thank you.